Power on.
Hi, friends, and welcome to the Pop Culture Retro-Rama podcast. I'm your host, Vic Sage, and I'm here to share memories, thoughts, and information on all manner of retro-related properties. Movies.
Are you telling me you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Music.
I want my MTV. All right.
Comic books.
These ain't your daddy's comic books, fanboy.
And toys.
It's Castle Grayskull. And it's mine.
Broadcasting to you from the depths of the Pop Culture Retrorama Vault. So, come join us, won't you?
Now, you're playing with power.
Friends, I hope you are all having a safe and happy holiday, and thank you for taking the time out of your hectic schedule at this time of year to take a moment and listen to this latest episode of the Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. For this show, since at the time of this recording, it is Christmas, I have chosen to focus on the December 4th, 1977 animated holiday special produced by Nelvana Limited, entitled A Cosmic Christmas. If you happen to have been kind enough to listen to our previous episode, featuring a top 5 list of Thanksgiving specials I released last month, you might recall that another animated holiday special produced by Nelvana was featured in that list. I will admit that I had thought about tackling something big, say like 1983's A Christmas Story, or possibly 1970's Scrooge. Those are indeed some fine subjects. But I decided, however, in the end, to focus on something personal to share with you for this holiday season, which is why I'm going to be talking about A Cosmic Christmas.
People around me, eyes to the ground, oh, why can't they look to the sky, they don't even see.
As I touched upon in that Thanksgiving episode for the podcast, in my youth, I rented a collection of 4 Nelvana animated specials, each based around a holiday. So much so that at one point my father actually forbid me to rent it anymore. Hundreds and hundreds of hours were spent watching this VHS tape. This was in the early 80s. Once I was done watching all 4, I would just rewind the tape and start again. The combination of a different style of animation than what I was used to, far different than what I was seeing on TV at the time, from the likes of Hanna-Barbera or Ruby Spear Productions, even Disney. Although Nelvana Limited, especially in their early animated specials, did match Disney in how moving the specials could be. Plus, the songs that were written and featured in these specials really spoke to me. In particular, in my youth, I felt very estranged from the rest of my classmates and kids my age. So that song clip I just shared moved me enough that sometimes I would tear up listening to it. Now, Nelvana, or as it was known, Nelvana Limited, is a Canadian animation studio that was originally founded back in 1971. When Patrick Lubert and Michael Hirsch, both graduates of York University in Ontario, Canada, made the acquaintance of Clive A. Smith. Smith had moved to Canada in 1967 and just so happened to have been employed by the Hallis and Batchelor Animation Studio in the UK, which had been founded by John Hallis and his wife, Joy Batchelor. This studio was responsible for the likes of 1954's animated adaptation of George Orwell's Animal Farm, as well as the Beatles animated series and even the first Lone Ranger cartoons. In addition, before leaving Hallis and Batchelor, Smith had the distinction, although an uncredited one, to have been part of 1968's The Beatles' Yellow Submarine. When Clive moved to Canada, he was working with Al Guest, acting as a senior animator and designer on both cartoon shorts and TV ads. Al Guest, by the way, had a hand in both Rocket Robin Hood and The Undersea Adventures of Captain Nemo. I mention this as those of you of a certain age might recall the latter being a modern interpretation of the Jules Verne character, as well as an ecological savvy version too. And it was shown on the CBS Captain Kangaroo television show here in the States. Apparently, towards the end of the 1960s, both Lubert and Hirsch were working at their own company they had formed called Laugh Arts. That's L-A-F-F. Basically, they created short films and did their very best to get advertising jobs. There were two other founders, and when they dropped out, that was the time that Hirsch and Lubert made acquaintances with Clive A. Smith. And soon, the trio hatched an idea about creating an entirely new company. An animation studio. Thanks to the Wikipedia, I have this quote from Michael Hirsch, who said, quote, Clive is an animator, and Patrick and I became interested in animation when we were in university together. At the time, there was no production industry per se in Canada, either in animation or in television production. There were stations making local shows, but you didn't have people making programs for sale around the world. So, blissfully unaware of all it would involve, we decided to try to start a company in Toronto, end quote. The company's name came about thanks to a mostly forgotten superheroine from the 1940s, Nelvana of the Northern Lights, part of a series of published comic books called The Canadian Whites that had originally been produced during World War II. In fact, the trio purchased the rights to these Canadian superhero characters, and with that, turned it into a half-hour documentary for the CBC, which is, of course, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. They even managed to produce a two-year art exhibit that toured around Canada, entitled Comic Art Traditions in Canada from 1941 to 1945. On top of all of that, both Lubert and Hirsch wrote a book in 1971 about the Canadian White series of comic books, which featured artwork by Clive A. Smith. Now, Nelvana of the Northern Lights was created by Adrian Dingle. The book was written and illustrated by Dingle as well. It turns out that his comic book creation was sort of based on a real person. It has been reported that Adrian had listened to stories about a woman from fellow painter Franz Johnston. The woman in question was either named Cecily or Connie Nelvana. Johnston had met this young woman while adventuring in the Arctic, and their time together apparently impressed Dingle enough that he decided to make a superheroine named after her. It is obvious that the character also affected Smith, Lubert, and Hirsch enough to name their fledgling animation company after her, right? Nelvana Animation began in a rundown apartment in the downtown area of Toronto. So bare bones was the studio that it has been said they built a wooden stand to secure the animation cells on and had it situated over the toilet. And that to create a zoom effect during production, they would just stack up phone books under the stand to bring it closer to the camera that was installed overhead. The trio managed to survive off a credit card that Patrick had obtained while attending York University. The company was supported by the meager limit on the card until they had racked up $7,500. And the bank apparently destroyed the card right in front of them. Somehow, though, through fast talking, the trio convinced the bank to grant them a $15,000 line of credit as a business. And it was the CBC that really gave Nelvana their start, purchasing 10 fillers for $1,500 apiece. Fillers were short and interesting visuals that could be inserted during a broadcast by the television station, if they were a minute shy of something to show. Like in the early days of television, when a test card or pattern was shown until it was time for the broadcast day to begin. Anyway, thanks to producing these fillers, the trio managed to be hired by the CBC to produce a series of 10 short films called Small Star Cinema. Some of these films were live action and others were animated. This led to a live action animation hybrid special for the CBC in 1974, a half-hour television special entitled Christmas Two-Step, in which a young girl wishes to secure the lead in a Christmas pageant. At this point, Nelvana had ceased being a company of three and became a company of 15 individuals. And thanks to their hard work, the company had made a name for itself in Canada, which is how they were given the green light on a fully animated half-hour special called A Cosmic Christmas. This also meant that the company needed to expand once again, going from a staff of 15 to 60. even moving out of that dingy apartment to a warehouse. In an interview with Kidscreen from back in 2001, Clive A. Smith commented that at the time, quote, "People warned us not to risk it," recounts Smith, "but what else were we going to do? We weren't pressured emotionally to worry about success or failure in those days. We just did what we loved doing," end quote. I will be sure, of course, to include a link to that very detailed history of Nirvana. It really is totally worth your time to read. The story idea for A Cosmic Christmas came from Patrick Lubert, with the teleplay credited to Ida Nelson and Laura Paul, with touch-up work on additional scenes by both Ken Sobel and Martin Lovett. Martin, by the way, would also voice multiple characters in A Cosmic Christmas, as well as providing the voice of Ard in 1981's Din segment from the animated heavy metal film. A movie that Nelvana Limited was offered, I should add, and passed on to produce their first and nearly last full-length animated feature, with 1983's Rockin' Rule.
Rock and rule. Good band, hot music, the best of times. It could have lasted forever. And rule. Journey to a world where the cosmic forces of music, magic, and technology collide, bringing you head to head with a beast from another dimension. The Beauty, songs by Deborah Harry. The Beast, songs by Lou Reed and Iggy Pop. The Beat, songs by Cheap Trick and Earth, Wind and Fire. Rock and rule.
Michael Hirsch, along with Jeffrey Kirsch and Patrick Lubert, were listed as producers. Clive A. Smith, naturally, was the director for A Cosmic Christmas. Now then, let us talk about the storyline for A Cosmic Christmas itself, a truly wonderful and quite moving animated holiday special, one that is set in modern day, and takes place on Christmas Eve, I might add. As the special begins, we see from the viewport of a space vessel, the planet Earth, and we hear the voice of one of three alien visitors. The one speaking, we later learn, is named Plutox, one of the handful of characters voiced by Martin Lovett. This scene is really intended to just let us know it's Christmas Eve, as the intergalactic visitors begin their descent. This is when we are introduced to our main protagonist, a young boy named Peter, played by Joey Davidson, a well-known child actor in Canada at the time, thanks to the Adventures of Timothy Pilgrim TV series. Young Peter is out and about in town along with his sweater and knit hat-wearing pet goose named Lucy. The boy is witnessing all of the headaches and stress that come from the holiday shopping season, like a woman screaming at a store clerk to wrap gifts faster, and the passing by of a decrepit and ignored bell ringer asking for donations for the needy named Santa Joe, also voiced by Lovett. It is pretty quick to see that Peter is totally different than the rest of the folks in the city. He is courteous and kind-hearted, which is the opposite of another young boy we meet, Marvin, played by Arrow's Greg Rogers. He and his three friends are troublemakers, to say the least, although it seems they are from a rougher side of town, at one point mocking Santa Joe when asked to donate for the unfortunate by replying they are the unfortunate. Peter, along with Lucy, take a moment to enjoy a nativity scene in a shop window, when they notice, in the window's reflection, what appears to be a bright star. The thing is, though, it's moving erratically and quickly. The young boy does his best to get the townsfolk to look up in the sky and see this event, but everyone is far too busy trying to get to the next store. Peter even attempts to get the town's police chief, Snurk, played by Dino Saucer's Marvin Goldhar, to look at the bright light as it travels across the sky. To his credit, Snurk does cast a glance up as Peter excitedly points towards the moving star. But to the police chief, it looks like merely a Christmas decoration the city has put up for the holiday. However, it appears Marvin and his gang are bullies, pelting Peter with snowballs and mocking his claim that he has seen, of all things, a spaceship. After an altercation with Lucy, Peter and his pet hightail it away from an extremely angry Marvin. Which is understandable, as the gang did more damage to their leader than the goose in the brawl. Peter and Lucy decide to head home, cutting through the snowy woods, just in time to witness the landing of the Interstellar Visitor's spaceship, which, after powering down, resembles an enormous black pearl. Trying to hide, the two watch as the three aliens, along with a floating and shape-changing sentient metal orb, disembark. After Lucy gives chase to the orb, Peter is introduced to the trio of alien beings. The young boy introduces himself and finds out that not only do they speak English, but they have arrived to seek out the meaning of a great star they saw in the heavens 2,000 years ago. Tracking it through the universe, they have arrived on Earth. Peter realizes they were referring to the Star of Bethlehem, that what they are seeking is to understand the meaning of Christmas. Like I've already mentioned, Peter is a good kid, so he acts as a guide to Plutox, and Lexicon, who is voiced by Richard Davidson, and Amalthor, who appears to be in charge of the mission, and happens to be played by none other than Duncan Rhaegar, of the Monster Squad and Zorro fame. Peter attempts to demonstrate the better aspects of Christmas in town, love and caring for one's fellow man, as well as peace. But everywhere he turns, he is thwarted by folks sadly too wrapped up in their own selves, including Police Chief Snark, who is upset that so many folks have called about witnessing the alien ship, in addition to the high-strung mayor, who only cares about his own safety and political standing. The easily agitated mayor, for what it's worth, was voiced by Chris Wiggins, who you Fright fans might know best as Jack Marshak from the Friday the 13th television series. It's fair to say that Peter isn't showing the trio of intergalactic visitors the best that humanity has to offer. But when listening in on Marvin and his gang's Christmas plans, they learn something worse. That the young boy seems intent on causing harm to Lucy.
Hey, this sounds more like Christmas.
What are you having for Christmas dinner?
Same as usual. Nothing. Jeez, that's too bad. Like we're having a caviar and pheasant under glass.
Yeah, and pâté de foie gras and roast goose and...
Hang on. What did you say?
Patty de foie gras?
No. Roast goose. I wouldn't mind having some of that.
Peter knows there is one place that Plutox, Lexicon, and Amalthor are sure to learn the true meaning of Christmas. That is, of course, his own home. As you might imagine, Peter showing up with three visitors from outer space is a little stunning to his father, mother, and grandmother. Although they appear to rest a little easier when it is explained they are not only peaceful, but are only allowed to observe. It is forbidden for them to act as more than spectators. Peter pleads with his family to understand that the aliens have come for Christmas. The young boys sent out to gather more firewood, leaving Lucy and the shape-changing orb to play out in the snow. I should add this orb, like I said, it's sentient, also has eyes and a mouth. When Peter returns, he asks his grandmother to tell of how Christmas was when she was a little girl. And, to the amazement and delight of Peter and his family, Plutox uses an ability to bring to life how she remembers Christmas to be. The standard Christmas tree becomes a large fir tree, decorated with ribbons and candles. You get the idea. This allows for an extremely beautiful song by Sylvia Tyson to be played over the scene.
You mean like this?
Time rolls fast and time rolls slow. We had so much so long ago. So long ago when I was young. Old stories told.
A brief aside, Sylvia Tyson might be best known for penning the popular song You Were On My Mind in 1962. The cover of it by We Five in 1965 reached the number 3 spot on Billboard's Hot 100 and stayed there for 5 weeks. Friends, growing up, I would never get tired of listening to my own grandmother talk about the Christmas of her youth. In my household, it was both my grandfather and father who were kind of the Scrooges in regard to this holiday season, with my grandmother and myself getting so much enjoyment out of putting up and decorating the tree, just spending what seemed like weeks and weeks just sitting and enjoying the beauty of the lights and ornaments on display. When I got older and found myself with disposable income, after my grandparents retired, I felt it was my duty to try and gift my grandmother with a holiday like she remembered as a little girl. Anyway, the warm memories in A Cosmic Christmas that are brought to life by Plutarch's are interrupted by the frightened honk of Lucy. You see, waiting outside in the woodpile was Marvin. He seems determined to have Goose for dinner, stealing Peter's pet and riding away through the snow on his bicycle. Peter and his family give chase through the woods, which ends up involving pretty much the entire town, who managed to show up outside of the intergalactic visitor's spaceship. It's a good thing, too, as Marvin ends up losing control of his bike in an attempt to escape, crashing and breaking through a frozen pond. It seems like the young boy can't swim and cries out for help. Peter is the first one on the scene and attempts to pull Marvin out, but is in the process dragged in himself. His parents and the townsfolk notice the ice won't support all of their weight at the same time, so they form a human chain in an attempt to rescue the two boys. But there aren't enough people to reach them. Watching all of this drama unfold is the trio of intergalactic visitors, who, against their sworn oaths to never interfere, lend their aid to the human chain, theorizing by helping they might learn the meaning of Christmas. And it is this act that saves both Peter and Marvin. Pretty quickly, the townsfolk turn on Marvin for his actions, really laying into him verbally about how horrible he is and that he'll never be any good, that he should be arrested. It is Amalthor who interrupts them, mentioning he doesn't understand why Marvin took Lucy in the first place. Coming to Marvin's defense is Peter's grandmother, who points out that maybe the young boy took the goose simply because he was hungry. This is something that strikes the intergalactic trio as odd, as if this is Christmas, how could anyone go hungry? This thankfully snaps the townsfolk out of thinking only of themselves, including Peter's parents, who ask the young boy to join them for dinner at their house. Everyone, in fact. As a Christmas party is thrown back at Peter's house, with Marvin and his gang invited too, Plutarch's Lexicon and Amalthor are gifted a handcrafted paper angel decoration by Peter's grandmother. Naturally, it is here where the mission is completed, as the visitors see firsthand the love and caring that the holiday can bring about in people. And as the aliens leave, we the viewers are left with the idea that things are going to be a lot better for Marvin and his own friends, and that they too have learned a lesson. Over the closing credits, the ending song by Sylvia Tyson is a slightly altered version of the clip I first played, although now instead of asking a question, it states that there are others that look up to the skies. As I mentioned earlier, the VHS tape that collected 4 of Nelvana Limited's holiday specials was a cherished rental in my youth. Luckily for me, many years later, one of my best friends was able to find that tape and gifted it to me one Christmas. Honestly, it could very well be the same tape I rented as a kid. For what it's worth, the holiday specials on that tape include The Devil and Daniel Mouse, which was produced for Halloween, Please Don't Eat the Planet, aka Intergalactic Thanksgiving, Romeo and Juliet, which was sort of a robotic take on Romeo and Juliet for Valentine's Day, and of course, A Cosmic Christmas. Now, while that VHS tape is long out of print, and I don't believe that there's ever been a DVD or Blu-ray release for this particular collection, I am happy to say that you can find them on online sources, but more importantly, you can buy them all on Amazon streaming. And I do believe that brings us to the end of this particular podcast. Once more, friends, I hope you're having a safe and very Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. Thank you, as always, for taking the time out of your very busy schedule and listening to me ramble about things pop culture and retro-related. Considering there are millions of podcasts out there, I truly do appreciate it that you are kind enough to listen to the show. For what it's worth, you can generally find me writing multiple times a day on the Pop Culture Retrorama site. If you want to check it out, you can go to www.popcultureretrorama.com. In addition to that site, I am also contributing daily on the Facebook page for the site, as well as the Diary of an Arcade Employee and Saturday Frights Facebook page. If you have any comments on the podcast or maybe suggestions for a future episode, you can contact me at vicsagepopculture@gmail.com. The Pop Culture Retrorama podcast is available on iTunes and Google Podcasts, as well as Spotify. If you like the show, why not help us attract new listeners by leaving us a review, a rating, and subscribing on iTunes? Help spread the word about the show with your friends and fellow pop culture aficionados. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our show is courtesy of Earl Green's TheLogbook.com, kindly used with his permission. As always, I want to personally thank The Retroist, who, for nearly 10 years, allowed me to share my love of all things retro, including creating podcasts like this one and more. And friends, I hope you will bear with me, because I also want to dedicate this show to my grandmother, who we lost 2 years ago. Grandmother, I sincerely hope you are able to hear this episode. And while I miss you, I thank you for teaching me the true meaning of Christmas, long before I saw this wonderful animated special. This has been a Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. Goodbye, and thanks for listening. The Pop Culture Retrorama podcast is not affiliated with or authorized by Nelvana, the CBC, or any of the businesses and individuals that have been mentioned in the show. All music and sound clips from A Cosmic Christmas and TV shows are the property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Audio clips are included for the purpose of review, criticism, and commentary only, and are not intended to infringe.
That has no meaning.